You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. This week's show is all about a very impressive exhibition I saw recently of sculpture and some drawings by the artist Annabeth Rosen that's currently on display at the Contemporary Jewish Museum in San Francisco. The show is called Annabeth Rosen, Fired, Broken, Gathered, Heaped. And we're going to discuss the show with the museum's director, Laurie Starr, the show's curator, Valerie Cassell Oliver, and the artist, Annabeth Rosen. Laurie Starr is the executive director of the Contemporary Jewish Museum in San Francisco, where Annabeth Rosen, Fired, Broken, Gathered, Heaped, will be on exhibition through January 19th, 2020. Laurie Starr, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much, Gary. It's a pleasure.
Could you introduce us to this exhibition, if you would, for our listeners?
I'd be delighted. The exhibition, Annabeth Rosen, Fired, Broken, Gathered, and Heaped, is the artist's first major museum survey, and it chronicles over 20 years of her work in ceramics. When you come to visit the exhibition, you will see that our entire top floor, it's about 6,500 square feet, is transformed with work over the last 20 years, filling the magnificent space of the Koshland Gallery. And I would recommend to visitors to break the rules, no pun intended, but to go to the back of the exhibition, in other words, counterintuitively. Don't start at the beginning. Like in Jewish tradition, Bereshit, don't start at the beginning. Start at the end, and you will see the evolution of this 20-year body of work, first with a magnificent, monumental, elevated off-the-floor, monochromatic piece made up of thousands and thousands of pieces of fired and glazed clay, in a installation that reminds me very much of archaeology and layers and layers and layers of archaeology. It also reminds me of layers and layers and layers of the earth and the sediment of the earth. And once you see this piece, it helps you understand how the artist, responding to nature in California, her adopted home, how nature inspires her work, as well as the whole history of art and the history of human presence on the planet.
So there's nothing left out of this show. This is the ultimate show. In fact, after this, you can just close the museum because there'll be nothing left.
Well, you know, it's one of these experiences with art that even for somebody who doesn't look at art very much, and by the way, just looking at art is a good thing to do, I would say. We live really stressful lives. We're looking for inspiration. We're looking for spirituality. We're looking for connection. We're looking for community. And also, we're just looking for a way to take our minds off of the world and its troubles and our minds off of our emails and our, you know, incessant screens and bombardment. And looking at art can be a very healing and growth experience for anyone. And looking at her art kind of reconnects you with what humanity is.
Well, Laurie Starr, had you been aware of Annabeth Rosen's work for a long time? Had you been wanting a show like this?
Well, you know, it was a dream come true when our former chief curator, who retired last year, Rennie Pritikin, introduced me to Annabeth Rosen, who had been a colleague of his when he ran, at the time it was called the Nelson Gallery at UC Davis. So Rennie had been a colleague of Annabeth's for many, many years. And of course, Rennie is a great intellect and innovator in the field of curatorial work and training the next generation of curators. He knew her work intimately and had, you know, worked in proximity to her studio at UC Davis, and also, as I did, understood her place in the larger narrative around ceramic sculpture, particularly the ceramic sculpture that has come to define California, from innovators like Robert Arneson. You know, her position at the university chair of ceramics is named for Robert Arneson. Other luminaries and rule breakers also, like Viola Fry, or artists like Linda Benglis, who happens to have an exhibition down in Palo Alto right now at the Gagosian Gallery. Other innovators like Viola Fry, who has the most amazing exhibition right now at the DeRosa. I knew of her stature within this, what do you call it when there's the gods of clay? The firmament of the gods of clay. I knew of her, but I hadn't met her. And when Rennie introduced me to Annabeth, and Annabeth talked to me about what it was like to grow up as a Jewish person in Brooklyn, right around the same time I was growing up in Jersey, you know, I really did see a connection between her origin story, the kind of family she grew up in, the milieu in which she grew up, and I really did see a fit for her as an artist with the Contemporary Jewish Museum. You know, some of our exhibitions are very deep on the Jewish spectrum of Jewish-specific content. As you know, we've shown all 613 mitzvot painted by Archie Rand. We've shown all of the illuminated pages of the Arthur Schick 1933 Haggadah. That's deep, deep on the Jewish spectrum. But we've also shown artists who are of Jewish heritage, or artists who are deeply influenced by Jewish culture, history, art, and ideas. And I see in Annabeth a deep influence on her work of not only Jewish experience, Jewish ideas, but all of the history of art and cultural anthropology, nature. And these are things Jewish artists and writers are always grappling with, along with artists of all different backgrounds. And the last thing I'll say is, when I met Annabeth, I thought, you know, there's a very deep intellect and knowledge here, you know, that you can kind of see it in her work. And that then, for us, opens up at the CJM a whole, what I call, topic of exploration. And we've chosen, apart from Annabeth's work as it stands on its own, and people should interpret it however they want, but we have chosen to create a series of programs, particularly around Kabbalah and Jewish mysticism, which really asks you to think about the space in between, the space you can't see, but the space that is enclosed within something. And there's so much of that within her work. And then, of course, there are so many other Jewish references. I saw in her work, in the breakage, that notion of breaking, consciously or not, on her part, it relates very strongly to the crises in Jewish history, such as the destruction of the First and Second Temple. And, of course, we know why we break a glass at a Jewish wedding, because it's to remember what the Jewish people had and what they lost. And the chance to constantly hold together and to rebuild. And just as the blue cube is buoyant outside the museum, the iconic element of Daniel Liebskind's architecture, it tumbles but it never falls. I see in Annabeth's work a gentle and fragile holding together of the broken, the gathered, the heaped, and the fired, but also the bound, the binding, of disparate elements that create then one whole. And that binding, which of course has another Jewish reference, the binding of Isaac, but the binding is, I think, a metaphor for humanity of, you know, we have to hold it together, keep it together. And that's how we reinvent ourselves, by binding and healing and moving on.
Lori Starr is the executive director of the Contemporary Jewish Museum in San Francisco. What's the location of the museum?
The museum is at 736 Mission Street, which is on Jesse Square, which is a fantastic public square, directly across the street from the Yerba Buena Gardens. And actually, less than a block away, just about a block away from SF MoMA.
Well, Lori Starr, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
Valerie Cassell Oliver is the curator of the show, Annabeth Rosen, Fired, Broken, Gathered, Heaped. And she's also the author of the book, the catalog of the show. Valerie Cassell Oliver, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So do you actually arrange the show, place the objects? You have people doing that? How does that work?
I think it works differently in multiple institutions. But for Annabeth Rosen, I mean, for me, I work primarily with living artists. So each and every project is really a collaboration with that artist. When Annabeth and I began talking about the exhibition, we talked about what we wanted it to look like. That we, you know, introducing ceramics and how ceramics, works created in ceramics exist in a space can range from the very sort of ho-hum. And so we wanted to really create something very dynamic, and that's why you see the installation, the look and the feel that it has. We wanted to create something very, very dynamic. So in that case, it began with our envisioning this exhibition, and then we then spoke to Jeff Shore, who was the head preparator at the Contemporary Arts Museum, to really sketch out for us what this thing would actually look like, and then eventually produce things like the pedestals and that we see that's been replicated for the Contemporary Jewish Museum presentation.
Right. So the objects that Annabeth Rosen made are sitting in some very specific things, and those things had to be manufactured. They don't have those things in the warehouse of the museum.
Oh, goodness, no. I mean, one particular pedestal is about 50 feet long. And no, that is not just sitting in a warehouse. I don't know if anyone could give it that much space. Plus, it's load-bearing. So, you know, when you think of the weight that these pedestals have to uphold, because these are very heavy objects. Annabeth is not shy when it comes to working with materials.
So in the book that is available, that's also called Annabeth Rosen and Gathered. What is it? I'm sorry.
Fire broken, gathered, heaped.
There's quite a bit of text. I mean, you really had to write a book about Annabeth Rosen, and so you had to analyze what this work means. I mean, obviously the work spoke to you, or you wouldn't have gotten involved in it in the first place, but when you're working with any artist, do you ever ask them, you know, what does this mean? Or do you just assume that what you're thinking about the work is all that matters in your interpretation? Or how does that work?
Well, first of all, the catalog, which I'm really thrilled about, the catalog is comprised not only of my essay, but also essays by Jenny Sorkin and Nancy Princenthal. So along with my sort of meditations on Annabeth, we also have, you know, the brain trust of these two extraordinary writers who have contributed to the catalog. As far as it goes with my my writing and my meditation about Annabeth, the beauty of working with living artists is that you do have that conversation, you do have that dialogue, and you do have that exchange. I wouldn't be so presumptive in thinking that I have the context for Annabeth's work. I am always in conversation with her, and as I said, it's really a partnership. There may be things that I see from my lens that she may not be thinking about. But I really need her voice to truly inform me about what motivates her to create the work that she creates. What is it that she's leaning into when she moves from one particular body of work to the next? So I really do want to amplify the artist's voice. That's part and parcel of what I do as a curator working primarily with contemporary artists. That being said, you know, there are things that I feel very strongly in bringing to the table, a sort of performative aspect to how Annabeth creates work. And I was giving a, I was leading a sort of docent training for individuals at the Contemporary Jewish Museum, and I had one particular woman ask in a very kind of caustic way, maybe, about my language, my use of the language of performance, and performance in the service of creating these works of art. And she said, well, isn't that just a studio practice? Don't all artists perform? And I said, well, yes, to a degree. However, conceptually, there are artists who really move beyond just the conventional notion of producing work. There is that sort of edge that's brought to bear, and you feel it when you go into that exhibition. And if we didn't believe that, then we wouldn't have called Jackson Pollock an action painter. You know, we had to create new language to talk about how he created, how he painted. And so it's not far-fetched to understand that when one translates that into how Annabeth works. There isn't language yet there to really talk about the performative nature of how she works in clay and how that clay subsequently becomes these really extraordinary objects made out of ceramic.
Okay, so we're on the radio, as you probably realize, and so yeah. Our listeners can't see Annabeth's work, although they can, by now I'm sure they've already gone and looked it up, but how would you describe it?
I think what we tried to do with the title of the exhibition was to give viewers the very simplistic understanding of something which is quite complex, that something can be fired, it could be broken, it could be gathered and heaped. And while it may seem a sequence of events to simply create a ceramic, an object made out of ceramic, it's also conceptually how Annabeth works, that she can gather these shards and bundle them and bind them and combine them in ways, almost like an assemblage artist working within the same material, to take fragments, to take broken things and really create extraordinary works of art from them. So she often talks about being in the studio, being in the near the kiln, and not being so disappointed when things fail, when things explode, when they blow up, because it may be just worth the destruction of the entirety of that object if one shard is perfectly formed that totally takes her idea about how to gather these things and how to represent them in a new way. So it is about notions of accumulation. It is notions about the precarious nature of firing things, taking clay and making it something less malleable, making it fixed, and the sort of unpredictable nature of what can happen, and embracing all of it. So there's a lot of, you know, listeners may imagine these sort of forms, and Annabeth does work with compiling and binding multiple forms together. It may be a form of a tube that then are gathered. There's a piece called twigs that are gathered and bound with wire. So you're using these materials like wire and rubber with things like ceramics. So it isn't the sort of very genteel nature of how one uses the medium. It's very hard and rough and unpredictable and humorous and funny and precarious all at the same time.
Well, the exhibition is called Annabeth Rosen, Fired, Broken, Gathered, Heaped. And there is a beautiful catalog. And one of the authors is my guest, Valerie Cassell Oliver, the curator of the show. Thank you so much for spending some time talking about it on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, it was my sincere pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. We have talked to the director of the Contemporary Jewish Museum and the curator of Annabeth Rosen, Fired, Broken, Gathered, Heaped. And now we turn to the artist herself. In addition to making the art featured in this exhibition, she's also the author of the book, which serves as the catalog for this show. She's current.
No, I didn't write the book. Sorry.
She's currently the Robert Arneson Endowed Chair at the University of California, Davis, and is joining us in the middle of her busy week. Annabeth Rosen, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for inviting me, Gary.
So you're not the author of the book. You're correcting me.
Yeah, no, the book is a collection of three essays. I made the work that's documented in the book, the images. But the meat of the book, next door to the image, the historical, critical, contextual, intellectual language part of the book that articulates and places the work in contemporary practices is written by the curator, Valerie Cassell Oliver, Jenny Sorkin from UC Santa Barbara, contemporary art historian, powerful feminist writer, contributed an essay. And there's also another incredible, we're so lucky to have Nancy Princenthal wrote an essay. She's a critic and writer. She also teaches at SVA in New York. And she wrote an essay that we also included. So I didn't do any of the writing in the book.
Just made the pictures. Just made the art that's in the pictures. How does that feel to have people writing about you? Is that I guess you're probably used to that, but what is it like?
It's fantastic. I mean, the best thing about being an artist is, well, one of the best things about being an artist is that you're part of this great conversation that's happening. When you start showing and meeting other artists and your whole life becomes kind of subsumed by your work, then you're part of this really big conversation that's going on about art. And it's very helpful, it's enlightening, it's meaningful to the work and to you to have these conversations with critics and curators whose life is also about contextualizing, understanding, building culture. So it's a great privilege, actually, to have people write about your work, even if they, you know, say things like, you know, that are unsupportive or are critical. It's worth having those discussions.
So even a bad review is a good thing?
Yeah, because it poses a lot of questions. And that's how you live your life anyway. And, you know, we talk about this a lot at school with students because there's a lot of critical discourse that takes place between our undergraduates and our graduates and our faculty and visiting scholars, visiting artists. There's no bad question. And anyone who asks something that you have not already thought about, you're kind of in trouble. Like, the questions people ask of you about your work are more likely questions you've asked yourself as well. So it's a great prompt. It's a great way to continue the conversation and deepen your understanding about the work you're doing. So, yeah.
Do most people ask the same questions every time when they look at your work?
Luckily, no. I mean, not always. No. Well, I've had a long career, so I've had many conversations. I've been working for a long time, and the world has changed. The world that has embraced, you know, ceramic art now with a fury, with a fever, asks different questions. So nothing stays the same. I mean, things stay the same, but day-to-day things change. In contemporary life, things change.
Your work is very abstract, but are you
influenced by current events, like either in the world or in your life?
Well, I think you'd have to just live under a rock and not speak or talk to anyone with blindfolds and earmuffs, not to be part of, especially now where everything is so difficult and so politicized and every day is a battle for civility. Yeah, I think I incorporate lots of issues. I mean, whether the work is directly narrative and literal reference to those things, all the pieces in the exhibition, many of the pieces that have that white kind of ghosty stained or foxed, you know, like moldy or bruised, and there are many examples where it looks like there's a wound or a scar or something healed over or something rotting through. Those started at, you know, 9/11, where my studio had like lots of these brightly, highly saturated color glazed pieces. And then after 9/11, I came in and just pouring like thin white clay over everything to kind of wash it out and make it kind of ghostly. And you know, you don't know if these pieces are found in nature, like rubble, or found someplace that's unfamiliar, or formed by a person. And it comes from that kind of ruin, that kind of aftermath, that kind of sense of remnant, what's left after. So there are lots of these underlying things, like the big green sample in the back. Like, I don't choose to say exactly, but if you came upon a giant radioactive chunk of Earth, maybe that's post, you know, something about our how we treat the environment and how we're headed towards doom. But I don't choose to put those kinds of, but maybe people, audience members, think about that, but if they don't, that's okay. I mean, I don't really need to lead anyone. I just need to work and provoke a conversation on individual level with the viewer.
Well, congratulations on the exhibition. But when you're making work, are you thinking about it being exhibited when you're creating it?
No. Every time you have a show, you think, oh, my God, this is the last time anyone's ever going to invite me. You always think this is the last time. Not only, you know, it will be a disaster, but you'll never go through this again. It's so much work. No, I rarely do you. I mean, sometimes you're invited to make a piece for a particular space. And actually, it's the instance right now, but I was building these pieces, and it just happened to be a good fit. But really, you just work to your own kind of imagination and your own direction. Like, the questions you ask are based upon, everything is concentric when you're an artist. Like, the thing you do today is reliant on the thing you did yesterday and the thing you did before, and you kind of propel yourself forward with a momentum at sometimes very small increments. And so unless you have like a big commission or a show 3 years down the line where you know that you have to build this piece for it, you really are engaged in a very intimate and focused conversation in your studio with the work and with yourself daily. For me, anyway, there's not a lot of, you know, you have very vague ideas that manifest themselves sometimes quite slowly while you're working.
You also make these enormous drawings or paintings that accompany the sculpture in the exhibition, Annabeth Rose and Shaken Stirred, Drawn Quartered. What is it?
I like yours.
Okay. So now the drawings, are they like a starting point for the sculpture?
It's a good question. Yes, they sometimes, the drawings are like my thinking. They're They are about the work, but not exactly the work. They're kind of tangential to the sculpture. They have a similar, they're really different visually. But what motivates them, what propels them, the questions I ask about the two distinct bodies of work are similar, about compacting shapes and forms, about building big things from small parts, about repetitive activity. It's like, you know, weaving or sewing, like every stitch, or writing every word, or every letter and every word and every sentence, or breathing even, for that matter. So it's reliant upon this kind of continued activity, both works. Sorry. Yes, that's what I would say.
So you mentioned that you've been a working artist for a long time, even though you're very young. Let's point that out.
Yes, very
young. When did you, when you were a little girl, did you say, I'm going to be an artist, or I am an artist, or when did that happen?
Oh, you know what? It actually never happened. I never actually, I was on a panel at school about building your career, and everyone talks about this transitional moment, this critical juncture when the dawn, you know, rose and the cobweb fell from their eye and they saw the light. But for me, I never had that. I always just was working. And I never ever said, okay, now I'm going to be an artist. In my family, as a kid, my sister was the artist, and I don't know what I was, but I was not the artist. And I just started working, I guess, in high school. I took a ceramics class, and then I went to college, and then never stopped. But never, it was only till recently, I think some people have that, like when they're married, and they can't say husband or wife for many years. But I didn't say I was an artist till, I don't know, rather recently in the relationship of all the years, compared to all the years I've been working. I was just thinking. I was just like a thinking, creative person who responded to things. But if that means I was an artist, then I was.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're chatting with artist Annabeth Rosen, whose work is currently on display at the Contemporary Jewish Museum in San Francisco.
You live in California now, but we know that you're originally from Brooklyn, is that right?
Yes.
And so what was your life like when you were a little kid?
It was torture, like all little kids. No, we had a beautiful life in Brooklyn. Everyone worked. I've said this before, in my generation when I was growing up, not everyone had a career. Like, some people just had jobs, and it was really working class, and my friends' parents were doctors and, you know, nurses, not doctors, but firemen and policemen and school teachers. It was a real workaday world, It was hard to be a child. I think any time is hard to be a child. I think it's a fallacy that people are happy when they're children. I think they're learning to be civilized and learning to communicate. And I think those fundamental primordial things are difficult to embrace, even in the most advantageous circumstances. And mine were pretty good. Big, loving family, and lots of goodwill, and lots of parties, and lots of cooking. And, I think I had a good childhood. Holidays, you know, family vacations were splendid.
And now you live in California, so were you always like, I can't wait to get to California. Eventually I'll move to California.
Oh, yeah, no, I was the only person in the world who never wanted to leave New York, probably one of the six. I actually came kicking and screaming and cried for 2 years. I was 40 when I came to California, so I had a pretty established network of colleagues, friends, professionals on the East Coast, my family. And so it was hard. It was very hard. I felt very alienated. Everyone in California, so like this is how I characterize it. Like everyone in New York is very concerned with external things, politics, education, culture, economics, is like religion. Like, this is the important issue. And then when I moved to California, everyone was so internally enlightened. Like, everyone knew what was good for them. And everyone did yoga and recycled and was super heightened aware of the environment and pollution and energy. And people were actually very internally enlightened. Everyone did what was good for them. Like, it didn't matter if they were working. They needed a bike ride or they needed a hike. They needed nature, like going to church. And so, and I just thought it was really interesting, that dichotomy of cultures. I love them both. I wouldn't want to forfeit anything now for either one of them. I've learned to really love both. But at first it was really hard, because I never thought of, like, what's good for me. I mean, you went down the subway. That is not good for you, but you went every day anyway. So, yeah. So I don't know. But California is a remarkable place. It's a beautiful place. It's been an incredible adventure. And I wouldn't have traded this experience for anything in the world, having lived here and know what life is like here. It's incredible.
Did it change your work being in California?
It did, actually. So much, yes.
Your work is healthier now?
Yes. My work is vegan. No, actually not. I eat my meat bloody, but yeah. It did change my work. When I was back east, I mean, this is a long time ago, remember. I have a long career to reflect upon. But at one point, I was making work that was directly abstracted from nature, like flowers and leaves and vines. But really, living in the city, I had really no idea what that really was. I didn't have much direct experience with the natural world that way. I never gardened. I never grew anything. Maybe we had morning glories on chain link when I was a kid. That was the yard. But when I moved to California and everything was so unbelievably lush and green and outrageously beautiful, seductively, overwhelmingly beautiful, that I couldn't make those things anymore. There was no need to make those things anymore. Of course, I couldn't make those things anymore. And my impressions have now been abstracted. At the time when I moved to California, these ideas were kind of abstracted from the natural world. And it was only till I came out here, when I actually did start, like, growing things, did I realize what these things looked like. And I was almost just making, like, illustrations or pictures of these things before. But now when I make something and say it's from the natural world or it's a flower, then I really know what that is, because I really grow flowers and watch them and learned a lot about time and timing and the seasons and climate by doing so. Things I had no idea about when I lived on the East Coast, because I did everything indoors. It's what you do in the East Coast, on the East Coast. I mean, I don't know, but yeah. I did.
Sure, because it's snowing and raining and it's humid and horrible outside.
Right, and yeah, exactly.
Well, your work, so it takes there's a process, obviously. You can't just make it. Like, when you make a painting or a drawing, I mean, there's a process there too, but it's right there when you're done. Whereas when you make ceramics, you don't know exactly how it's going to come out, or do you? I mean, you really are so good at, you know, exactly what it'll look like when it's done.
No, you never know. I don't know how good you'd have to be. I mean, the only way to do that is to have it fabricated, you know, is to do make a diagram and have it fabricated either by someone else or by some machine, where you carefully control all aspects of the thing. And sometimes you may have to do that. I haven't had to do that, but sometimes I may have to do that. But and either you commission someone or something to make your thing. For me, it's a little of both. I mean, you're driving very hard to get to something, you're compelled to get to some image or idea or sensation, something subcellular that you can't even articulate. And you know when you're close, and you know when you have a great deal of distance to cover. And sometimes you get close in ways you don't expect and leads you in another direction, a tangential direction, which can be very exciting. And the point is that you don't ever quite hit the thing on the nose. You just don't ever hit the button. You just don't ever get that close. And it's kind of lucky, because that's what keeps you looking, keeps you going, that sense of, you know, if you're satisfied, but every time you make something, you have a new question, and then you have more work to do. Even if it's a good piece, it's provocative and sends you someplace, good or bad. If you're thinking, if you're asking. That's the hardest thing, I think, sometimes about being an artist for a very long time, and that is negotiating the changes in your work, and not only for the public, but, you know, how it changes for you, too. So that's a whole other conversation. But
now, you have the title of the Robert Arneson Endowed Chair at the University of California, Davis, and I was thinking about Robert Arneson because I was very familiar with his work, and then I saw a show of his work where all of it was there. You know, it was like just a gigantic Arneson show. And the work really changed in my mind once I saw it, like, all together.
Mm.
Do you feel that is one of the factors in having a show like Fired, Broken, Gathered, Heaped, that all your work is together?
That's a great analogy. Yeah, I do. I actually think, I'm so glad you asked that, because I actually think of, like, that big, long platform with all the pieces on it as, it's kind of like the history. It's kind of like, I'm not sure you're supposed to, I intended or thought about this until after the fact, thought about it till recently. Like, it's not about each piece on that platform, and there's, I don't know, 60 pieces or something there. I don't have the exact number, but it's like just to get an impression of the development of thinking and the development of working. It's like if I ever send you a letter, if I ever write you a letter, you probably couldn't read my handwriting. But if you look at it and then look away, you'll know what I said. So I'm not exactly sure what I'm trying to articulate, but it's not about each piece, but it's about a way of thinking, about a way of looking, about a way of perceiving yourself in the world, and a way of asking questions. So in that regard, that comprehensive kind of investigation, that could lead to some very interesting conversations, which I hope the show does, which I think, you know, Valerie Cassell Oliver, who was the curator, came to me and started asking these questions about the work. And that's where, you know, the whole idea of the show got to be kind of developed. Yeah, so it's about a way of thinking, I think. So, yeah, I love that it's all together. So even I often think also like museums or collections, and students too, like if they have just one piece. If you have just one piece, then it's the example, then it's the masterpiece. But if you make two pieces, then you have this conversation going on about which one satisfies which quotient or which criteria. And then if you have three pieces, it gets very complicated. One's maybe really distant, two are pretty close and in conversation to each other. Then if you have a whole room full of pieces, you have this very complicated dialogue of process and material and ideas, and it can be very interesting. It can be very exciting, and I don't know about other people, but I'm excited when I walk into the gallery, the Koshland Galleries at the Contemporary Jewish Museum. I mean, so maybe other people catch that a little bit.
Well, the show is called Annabeth Rosen, Fired, Broken, Gathered, Heaped. And Annabeth Rosen, thank you so much for spending some time talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, Gary, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for including me in your work. I'm quite honored. I'm quite pleased.
The exhibition, Annabeth Rosen, Fired, Broken, Gathered, Heaped, will be at the Contemporary Jewish Museum until January 19th, 2020. That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.